Okay, welcome to episode 34 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I guess I am no longer an MS4. I guess I'm some kind of PGY1. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about all the antiviral medications, and hopefully you find this high for your exams. So let's begin. So obviously we have to talk about herpes, right? And there are many kinds of herpes, right? There's like herpes 1 through 8. You probably want to know what those are for your tests, right? So there's herpes 1. That's the one that could cause oral or genital herpes, but generally causes oral herpes. There's herpes 2, right? So HHV2. That one could also cause oral or genital herpes, but it usually causes genital herpes. And then HSV3, right? You're thinking about VZV. Varicella zoster virus. For HHV4, you're thinking of EBV, the Epstein-Barr virus. Remember, it uses CD21 to get into B cells. And then for CMV, you're thinking of herpes 5, okay? HHV5 is CMV, cytomegalovirus. Remember the monospot negative mononucleosis-like syndrome. For herpes 6, you're thinking about roseola. And for herpes 8, you're thinking about Kaposi's sarcoma, right? That's pretty classic in HIV. So how do you treat herpes, right? So the gold standard drug in general that you'll see on exams all the time is acyclovir, okay? Acyclovir or an oral formulation, valacyclovir, okay? So acyclovir is used to actually treat HSV and VZV. And how does acyclovir work? Acyclovir is a guanosine analog, okay? It's basically the nucleoside form. So because it's a nucleoside, to be incorporated into DNA, it needs to be turned into a nucleotide. Okay, so it's an analog of guanosine. There's a thymidine kinase that will add 3-phosphates to it. And once that acyclovir, that guanosine analog, has been activated, it then basically inhibits DNA polymerase as it's incorporated into the DNA strand. Because the thing is, if you look at normal DNA, there's a hydroxy group on the 3' position. Acyclovir does not have a hydroxy group on the 3' position. So that phosphodiester bond will not form. Right, so its mechanism of action basically is that it's a chain terminator. That's how acyclovir works. And the good thing is the thymidine kinase is expressed specifically in the herpes virus. That's why acyclovir is generally a relatively clean drug. But the thing is, acyclovir is actually cleared renally, right? So it can actually like accumulate in renal cells, right? It can destroy them. That's why acyclovir is nephrotoxic. Another thing is it could actually crystallize in the nephron, and it can cause a crystalline nephropathy, right? So a person can get nephrolithiasis with acyclovir. And if you know that it's activated by that thymidine kinase, that should hopefully tell you that the mechanism of resistance is a mutation in that thymidine kinase. And just to stretch our thinking a little bit, if you're thinking in terms of Michaelis-Menten kinetics, think of acyclovir as a competitive inhibitor of DNA polymerase, okay? So basically, by giving acyclovir, right, to your... Just think of it more in terms of competitive inhibition mechanics. You'll see where I'm going as we go to other antiviral meds. And then valacyclovir, it's basically cyclovir, but it's orally bioavailable. In general, acyclovir is given as an IV formulation, but valacyclovir is the form of acyclovir that has a better oral bioavailability. Now, the next drug I'll jump into is ganciclovir and valganciclovir, okay? For your exam, think of these as the primary treatment for CMV, okay? And basically, these drugs, so ganciclovir is a guanosine analog as well. The only thing is that it's not activated by a thymidine kinase. It's actually activated by a different kind of kinase known as the UL97 kinase, okay? That UL97 kinase adds 3-phosphates, and then you have activated ganciclovir. Okay, and again, ganciclovir is the drug of choice in the treatment of CMV. Okay, remember, CMV is the one where a person has a mononucleosis-like presentation, but the monospot test is negative. And remember, CMV can cause a high-yield congenital cluster of things that are tested on exams, especially with the periventricular calcifications on imaging. And CMV is a pretty common infection in HIV patients, right? So if a HIV patient has a CD4 count less than 50, you want to begin to think about diseases like CMV or MAC, right? Remember, MAC, that's where you prophylax with azithromycin. And again, the mechanism of resistance is sort of similar to that for acyclovir. If you mutate that UL97 kinase, ganciclovir does not work anymore. And again, think of it in terms of competitive inhibition mechanics if you're going along the Michaelis-Menten pathway. And the big side effect you want to know with ganciclovir is myelosuppression. Yes, it's the UL97 kinase that activates it, but there are other kinases in us that can activate ganciclovir, Okay, if those kinases activate ganciclovir, it can incorporate into like our own DNA, say for example the lymphocytes, and it can suppress the bone marrow. Acyclovir actually can cause bone marrow suppression as well. But for exams, if they say bone marrow suppression, antiviral, the first thing I want you to think about is ganciclovir. Valganciclovir is just, again, the oral formulation of ganciclovir. Then the next drug I'll talk about is Foscarnet. Okay, Foscarnet is actually a pretty broad spec drug. It can treat HSV, it can treat VZV, it can treat CMV. Basically, there's the least resistance of these bugs to Foscarnet. And one good thing about Foscarnet, there is less resistance because you don't need to phosphorylate it to activate it. The other drugs, you do need to phosphorylate them first, but not so for Foscarnet. Foscarnet is a pyrophosphate analog, okay? It actually inhibits DNA polymerase. So basically, it binds in the pyrophosphate pocket of DNA polymerase, and the active site of DNA polymerase changes shape. So no new nucleotide can bind to DNA polymerase. So think of Foscarnet as working with irreversible non-competitive inhibiting kinetics, if you may. So basically, like, your Vmax is going down with Foscarnet, but there's no change to your KM. Contrast that with acyclovir and ganciclovir. And it's nephrotoxic, but they don't really test that. And basically, the only time you will ever use Foscarnet on any exam for anything is if a person has like acyclovir or like ganciclovir resistant, like HSV, VZV, or CMV. Okay. So now let's talk about HIV and the HIV drug. So we probably should talk about the life cycle of HIV. Don't forget, HIV is an RNA virus, right? It has like GP41 on its surface that actually has the ability to bind to the CXCR4 receptor on the surfaces of T cells, right? And with that happening, you can make the fusion of HIV with a T cell possible. And it's an RNA virus, but it needs to integrate into our genomes, right? So it needs to be converted to DNA. And that's done by reverse transcriptase, right? Remember, reverse transcriptase depends on RNA as the template, and it makes DNA as the product. So it's an RNA-dependent DNA polymerase. And then once you've made that DNA, you integrate it into the genome with integrase, okay? And then if you transcribe that DNA, you can make a HIV polypeptide. But that polypeptide is useless. The HIV polypeptide has to be broken down into individual proteins by an enzyme known as protease, okay? And then once you make those individual proteins, you make those variants, and then you package it out for disbursement to other parts of the body. Also, please note this, right? So there's also this CCR5 receptor. You actually find it on the surface of white cells like macrophages. In fact, HIV in many cases tries to use the CCR5 receptor to get into our white cells, right? So in fact, in general, if a person has a CCR5 mutation, they have like a relative resistance to HIV, because HIV in general loves to use CCR5 as its first point of contact to gain entry to the immune system. Now, there are three high yield genes you want to know about in HIV, right? So there's the POL gene, P-O-L. Okay, just remember RIP, like rest in peace, for the products of the protein products of the POL gene. Okay, you get the R for reverse transcriptase, the I for integrase, and the P for protease. They all come from the POL gene. And then there's the OMF gene. The OMF gene codes for GP160. It's basically a polypeptide that's cleaved by protease into GP41 and GP120. And then there's the GAG gene. The GAG gene codes for P24. The P24, the high yield thing you want to know about this is it's the antigen that's actually detected in the ELISA test that's used for HIV. So once you understand the life cycle of HIV, that's the thing I always tell people. If you're trying to learn, just try to organize information. Regardless of how nebulous a given body of knowledge is, if you can try to gain some understanding and try to put it in a very good schema, it's much easier to remember, much easier to memorize. So now you know the life cycle, the drugs should fall into place nicely, okay? So the first drugs we'll start with are the drugs that inhibit the entry of HIV into cells, right? So the fusion inhibitors. So there are drugs that bind to GP41. The big one you want to know for your exam is enfuvirtide. Enfuvirtide, it's a fusion inhibitor, and it prevents the entry of the virus into host cells. And you want to know that enfuvirtide works only for HIV-1, doesn't do anything for HIV-2, okay? Doesn't do anything for HIV-2. Now, the other drug I'll talk about is Maraviroc. Think of Maraviroc. The buzzword you're looking for in exams is chemokine receptor blocker. The thing is, it binds to CCR5, and again, that prevents the HIV virus from fusing with our white cells, and it prevents HIV from gaining entry into our white cells. And again, it only works for HIV. So these special drugs like Enfuvirtide and Maraviroc only work for HIV1. They do not work for HIV2. And then we go to the class of the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, right? So the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, there is two kinds of reverse transcriptase inhibitors, okay? There are those that are competitive inhibitors, okay? So basically they increase KM, but they do nothing to Vmax. And then there are those that are non-competitive inhibitors. Those decrease Vmax, but they do nothing to KM. And the competitive inhibitors are the drugs known as NRTIs, the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And the high-yield drug names you want to know here are drugs like stavudine. That's a high-yield one that shows up on exams. There is didanosine. There is emtricitabine. Emtricitabine is actually also used to treat Hep B. There is lamivudine. Lamivudine also is used to treat Hep B. There is a zalcitabine. That one's lower yield. There's zidovudine. You definitely want to know zidovudine. That's the one that's commonly known on exams as AZT. It's actually used to prevent a vertical transmission. That's the classic way it shows up on exams. It's used to prevent like vertical transmission. Use it for like post-exposure prophylaxis for like 6 to 12 weeks in an infant. If you're like, oh, maybe this infant contracted HIV from mom. Tenofovir is another NRTI. Another high yield thing you want to know about it is it's also used for Hep B. So basically, to treat Hep B, just remember Hep Belt, like Hep B, and then an ELT, the E for emtricitabine, the L for lamivudine, and the T for tenofovir. And then another high yield NRTI you want to know about is abacavir. I'll talk about these drugs in a bit. And again, these drugs increase KM, they do not change Vmax. Contrast that with the non-competitive inhibitors. These are the NRTIs, the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. The big ones you want to know here, there's nevirapine. That's probably what's used most commonly these days. And then there's efavirenz, right? And efavirenz, you don't want to give it to a pregnant woman. It's a teratogen, and it's also neurotoxic, right? So it can cause like vivid dreams because it actually has the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier. These drugs, basically, they bind to a different site on reverse transcriptase that essentially prevents it from binding new nucleotides. So again, they should decrease your Vmax, but there should be no change in KM. Now, here's the thing. There's tons and tons and tons of side effects you'll see in first aid with these drugs. But I will say in general, if you know these side effects I'm going to mention right now, you probably will be able to answer any question within reason related to the side effects of these HIV meds, especially these reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So I'll just mention like one side effect for each, but those are the ones that I've seen tested very commonly on exams, right? So the first group is stavudine didanosine. So these are NRTIs. The big side effect you want to know here is pancreatitis. That's it. For zidovudine, the big side effect you want to know is bone marrow suppression. For efavirenz, I already mentioned it's a teratogen, so don't give it to a pregnant woman. And it also causes vivid dreams, right? So it's neurotoxic. And then for abacavir, you want to know about the hypersensitivity reaction on HLA-B57. In fact, they can give you an exam question and say, oh, prior to prescribing abacavir, what's the next best step in management? And the next step in management is to test for HLA-B57, because there's been studies that show like 8% of people could get like a life-threatening hypersensitivity reaction to abacavir. So that's all I'm going to say about the RTIs. Now, the next drugs I'll jump into are the integrase inhibitors. They are basically the cleanest HIV drugs. They have few, if any, side effects, and they all end in gravir, right? So like elvitegravir, raltegravir, dolutegravir, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's essentially all I'm going to say about those. They don't really test any side effects with those drugs, but they're very clean. They have very few side effects. Now, the protease inhibitors, basically, they all end in navir. Okay, so drugs like atazanavir, ritonavir, indinavir, darunavir. I'll say of all these drugs, probably the highest yield ones to know about in terms of side effect profile is ritonavir and indinavir. Okay, the class side effects of all these medications is that they cause the metabolic syndrome. Okay, people don't really know why, but they think that these drugs potentially mess with insulin signaling. Okay, so they tend to cause like fat redistribution, so like a buffalo hump around the neck. So that's not something that's unique to steroids. That's something that can happen with olanzapine, the atypical antipsychotic. It could happen with the protease inhibitors, but it could also happen with the chronic use of corticosteroids. Now, in terms of specific side effects, the first one I'll talk about is ritonavir. Ritonavir, the big thing you want to know here is that it's a very powerful inhibitor of cytochrome P450. In fact, it's very good at boosting the levels of many other medications because it slows down their metabolism. That's why it's actually still used as a HIV med, because it makes it possible for you to give much lower doses of the other HIV drugs. And then indinavir, the big thing you want to know about indinavir is kidney stones. Indinavir can cause nephrolithiasis. Don't forget that the anti-seizure med, topiramate, can also cause nephrolithiasis. Those are very classic side effects. They love testing with these drugs. And again, in general, for HIV, you give two NRTIs plus some other kind of drug. You can give two NRTIs plus a protease inhibitor, or two NRTIs plus an integrase inhibitor, or two NRTIs plus one of those fusion inhibitors. Although remember, those fusion inhibitors work only for HIV-1. They do not work for HIV-2. Now, for hepatitis, and HIV-1, if I'm not mistaken, is more common in the US. HIV-2 is more common in like African countries. Okay, now, we are done with HIV, so let's jump to the hepatitis virus. For Hep B, right, the ways you can treat Hep B, you can use interferon alpha, right, or you can use those NRTIs I mentioned. Remember Hep B ELT, so Hep BELT. So you can use emtricitabine, lamivudine, and tenofovir. Okay, for Hep B, you could also use ribavirin. Ribavirin has multiple mechanisms of action. One you probably want to know about is that it can work as a guanosine analog, so it can prevent the conversion of inosine monophosphate or IMP to guanosine monophosphate or GMP. Okay, the enzyme that makes that conversion from IMP to GMP and like XMP, like xanthine monophosphate, is an enzyme known as inosine monophosphate dehydrogenase. It so happens that ribavirin inhibits IMP dehydrogenase, but don't forget that IMP dehydrogenase can also be inhibited by the immunosuppressant mycophenolate mofetil. Mycophenolate mofetil also inhibits IMP dehydrogenase. And then ribavirin also inhibits RNA polymerase, right? And again, like I said, you can use ribavirin to treat Hep B. You can use it to treat Hep C. This is a little more controversial, but you can actually use it to treat RSV as well. Although I will say that I have just never seen that done clinically. But you could use it for RSV. RSV on exams, usually I see that more with treatment more with palivizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against the virus. You can use it to prevent RSV because you essentially prevent it from getting in contact with epithelial cells, especially like in the lungs and the airway. Now, for Hep C, I think some background will make remembering these drugs a little easier on your brain. The thing is, Hep C is a virus, okay? And for Hep C to like spread to other cells of the body, just like HIV, we say that HIV has this polypeptide that's made, and then some kind of protease in HIV chops up those polypeptides to make proteins that can then be packaged into like variants, into viral particles. Same thing with Hep C. Okay, Hep C has this magic polypeptide, and that magic polypeptide has to be broken down into individual Hep C proteins, if you may. Okay, and it's a protease that makes that chopping up happen. And those proteases, the buzzwords you want to remember, are NS3A and NS5A. NS3A and NS5A are the proteases that chop up the Hep C polypeptide. Okay. Now, the thing is, if you chop up that Hep C polypeptide, there is a non-structural protein that can be made from that polypeptide. It's one of the subunits of that polypeptide, if you may. That non-structural protein actually helps with Hep C viral replication. The buzzword you want to remember for that non-structural protein is NS5B. So again, NS5A and NS3A are proteases in Hep C. NS5B is a non-structural protein derived from the Hep C polypeptide. That's the schema I want you to take away from this podcast. It's derived from the Hep C polypeptide, and it helps with viral replication. So now you'll have that background, right? So let's talk about the Hep C drugs. For Hep C, you can actually treat with boceprevir. Boceprevir is an NS3A5A inhibitor, okay? So basically, boceprevir is a protease inhibitor. Okay, but in this case, the proteases it's inhibiting, NS3A and 5A, it essentially prevents the formation of the individual proteins that are necessary for Hep C to function. The next drug is sofosbuvir, right? So if you watch TV at all, I know that's not a common pastime of medical students in this country, but if you watch TV, you've probably heard about Harvoni, It's a combination of sofosbuvir and some other drug that's like loyal for step one, ledipasvir. Sofosbuvir is an NS5B inhibitor. So it inhibits that non-structural protein derived from the hep C polypeptide. Okay, so it basically interferes with hep C viral replication because it's taking that protein out of commission. Now, you could actually use interferon alpha as well to treat hep C. Okay, this is basically not the standard of care anymore in general, okay, because it has many nasty side effects, right? So like it's like you have like a flu-like illness for months on end, pretty nasty. And depression is actually another well-known side effect of interferon alpha. In fact, before a person is prescribed interferon, a relative contraindication is actually a history of depression. Believe it or not, that's a very good NBME exam question. Interferon alpha, you generally have to be screened for depression before you're prescribed interferon alpha. So a history of depression is a relative contraindication to the administration of interferon alpha. And I know I'm throwing all these interferon words around. Please, please, please do not confuse interferon alpha that's used for hep B and C with interferon beta that's used to treat MS. Interferon beta is for multiple sclerosis. And don't confuse interferon alpha again for hep B, C, or interferon beta for MS with interferon gamma. That's actually used for macrophage disorders like CGD, right? So like chronic granulomatous disease, where a person has a deficiency in NADPH oxidase. You use interferon gamma for treatment with that. Because remember, interferon gamma is made by T helper 1 cells, if I'm remembering correctly. And interferon gamma activates macrophages, right? And you want to basically use, I sort of think of interferon gamma as something that gives macrophages like six packs or whatever, like makes them like super strong, okay? That's done by interferon gamma. Interferon gamma is a very good drug for treating macrophage disorders. An unusual exam question could also be like a person that has brittle bone disease, right? So osteopetrosis. Remember, osteopetrosis is a macrophage disorder, right? So that's where macrophages, a kind of macrophage, if you may, the osteoclasts, have a carbonic anhydrase 2 deficiency, so they cannot make acid to pump across that ruffle border to resorb bone, okay? You also treat osteopetrosis with interferon gamma. So that's it with the hepatitis viruses. So let's jump to the last viruses I'll talk about, and I guess the last set of antivirals, that's the influenza virus. The thing is, our cells, right, they base like our neutrophils, our macrophages, they form like endosomes or I guess phagosomes around the influenza virus, okay? And then they endocytose that stuff. And then that phagosome fuses with a lysosome to form a phagolysosome. Now, the thing is, for a lysosome to do its job, okay, it needs an acidic environment. But the thing is, the influenza virus actually loves that. Because I sort of think of the influenza virus sort of like strolling into your cells and it's wearing like this jacket and it's like, oh man, this lysosome is a little too warm. Let me get rid of this jacket, right? So it's uncoating. For that uncoating process to happen, it actually needs an acidic environment in the lysosome. Now, if you want to create an acidic environment, well, you need something like a proton pump, if you may. That proton pump is known as M2. It's the M2 proton pump that brings in hydrogen ions into the lysosome and makes the lysosome's lumen acidic so that the influenza virus can uncoat. So, once the influenza virus has uncoated, it replicates and it wants to go from like one cell to the other, right? The thing is, there's like this tether. So, sort of think of like a boat being attached to like shore. There's this tether that holds the influenza virus to the cell it has just infected. That's sialic acid. So if it wants to go away from that cell and go infect someone new, it needs to chop up that tether. Okay, that tether is chopped up by an enzyme known as neuraminidase. If neuraminidase does its job, you chop up that tether and then the influenza virus can go around and infect some new cell. It can sail off into the sunset or whatever it's called these days and infect new cells. So how do we treat influenza? Once you have the background, it's much easier to remember the drugs, right? So basically, the drugs for influenza, you can divide them into two classes. Drugs that don't work, okay, but are still tested mainly for pharmacologic interest, and then drugs that do work, that are actually like used in clinical practice. So the drugs that don't work, okay, but are still tested, that's where we have amantadine and remantadine. Amantadine basically inhibits that M2 proton pump, so you do not make a low pH in the lumen of the lysosome, so the influenza virus cannot uncoat. There's essentially 100% resistance to amantadine, so no one uses that stuff anymore. Remantadine is also a drug that works the same way. And again, these drugs, they actually worked only against influenza A. There are many kinds of influenza. There's like influenza A and B. They only work for influenza A. They do not work for influenza B. But again, 100% resistance, they don't work. If you're a physician, you should never prescribe this for your patients. But it so happens that amantadine actually increases the release of dopamine in the central nervous system. So it's actually used now to treat Parkinson's disease. So I guess good for the pharmaceutical company that discovered that that use. Now, the drugs that actually do work, that's where we have the neuraminidase inhibitors. So drugs like zanamivir or oseltamivir, okay? Oseltamivir, if you've ever had the flu before, you've ever heard of the drug Tamiflu. Tamiflu, I believe, is oseltamivir. So these drugs, basically, they inhibit neuraminidase, so the influenza virus cannot go from one cell to the next. And you have to give these drugs within the first 48 hours of infection. After 48 hours, there's no proven benefit with these drugs. And the thing is, these drugs actually don't cure the influenza. They just reduce your symptomatology by like 1 to 2 days. But you definitely want to know that these drugs are effective against influenza A and influenza B. They work for influenza A and influenza B. Super high yield to know those. As against amantadine, remantadine, that work only for influenza A. So, if I'm not mistaken, I believe those are all the high-yield antivirals that you're responsible for in step 1 or step 2 or step 3, whatever. I would make another podcast, hopefully in the next few days, about the antifungals. And with that, I guess maybe joining the antiparasitics as well. But with that, we should be done with the antibiotics. I know it's a lot of stuff, but if you know the stuff I've talked about in this podcast, you should be good to go. So, I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful evening. I really hope the Cleveland Cavaliers win their game 2. Yesterday was pretty sad with them losing the game from the blunders with J.R. Smith. But hopefully things go better on Sunday, and I will see you guys in the next podcast. Have a wonderful weekend, and God bless. Thank you.